cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloud he draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we'll read stories from two different sources. Our first is from Cowboy Short Stories, published by Blue Ribbon Magazines, and this is from Volume 2, Number 4 of November 1939. I remind you, as I usually do, that our stories may be edited for recording. Our first tale is entitled Fighting Coward by E. B. Mann. Ruddy Curran whipped a fast left at Dan Coward's jaw and missed. The next thing he heard was the raucous jeers of the half-dozen or so skirt-shy cowpokes decorating the bunks of the 97 bunkhouse. This was the night of the rodeo, which Pop Turner and his daughter, June, put on each year to celebrate the beginning of the dude season. And Reddy and Dan had got to scuffling in the bathhouse and had put on the gloves to settle it. Don't get me wrong, Reddy and Dan were friends, sidekicks. You may have heard of Red. He was a pug. A good one, too, or so they said. Good enough to be cock of the walk in any ordinary bunkhouse. Well, Dan was kneeling over Reddy almost before he hit the floor. I'm sorry, Red. I didn't mean. You all right, kid? Reddy sat up and laid the heel of his glove against his jaw. The jaw waggled and Red nodded. I reckon so. All in one piece, anyway. Doggone you, Dan. In spite of all I've taught you, you leave yourself wide open for a left hook. But every time I try to land one and cure you of it, you land that right. It just ain't right. Pop Turner chuckled. Make up your mind, Reddy. Either it is a right or it ain't one. Whatever it is, it's poison, ain't it? You know, Dan, after seeing that fancy shooting act you done this afternoon and seeing you battle Reddy this evening, it's plumb surprising to me that a man with yo' gifts... He stopped talking suddenly and his face got red, as if he'd choked on something. Well, he'd choked on Dan Coward's reputation. What he'd started out to say, and what everybody listening knew he'd started to say, was, "It's plumb surprising that you'd let Spade Malone make a doormat out of you." Which was exactly what a lot of folks were wondering. Dan Coward had been in the Twin Rivers country for 10 years or better, and folks liked him. He was a big and likable cuss, and he could do a man's work afoot or on horseback. Nobody stopped to figure out whether he was a fighting man or not, because he'd never had any trouble. Some men draw trouble the way a sorghum can draws flies. Others go through life without a riffle, yet nobody ever doubts their courage. You just figure if trouble happened, they'd face it, and you let it go at that. It was that way with Dan, until Spade Malone got there. It seems these two had known each other as kids, and Spade no sooner laid eyes on Dan than he started riding him. Did it deliberate, Spade did, and mean, too. Made it real plain that he figured Dan's name was more than just a handle, that it was descriptive, coward, and Dan took it. You know how things like that take hold. Folks saw Spade bearing down on Dan, and Dan sidestepping him, and got to thinking how Dan had sidestepped other times. Before, they figured Dan just wasn't quarrelsome and was willing to let his head save his knuckles. Now, they began to wonder if maybe Spade was right. Dan could toss bottles into the air and bust him with a six-gun. He could lick Reddy Curran with the gloves on, but could he fight bare-fisted? And did he have the guts to sling lead at a target that could shoot back? That was what folks were asking, and the more Spade rode him, the nearer they came to arriving at an answer. Pop Turner coughed.
I better go. Dance has been going on for most an hour, and if I ain't there to call them square dances, June'll scalp me. Well, so long.
He ducked and made his getaway. The rest of the bunch followed, and that left Dan and Reddy to dress by their lonesomes, and Red was sore. He said,
"He's right. It beats all hell how a man like you lets a loud-mouthed four-flusher like Malone bluff him. It ain't a lack of guts, Dan, I know that. I thought it was, at first, until that morning you snapped that rattler out of my blankets by the tail, and you barehanded. Well, what is it anyway, you jughead? Maybe I'm just living up to my name, Reddy, like Spade says. Dan was under the shower now. They had those things at the 97 now that it was a dude ranch, and his voice was sort of muffled. Reddy looked at him, but Dan's eyes were closed, and his face was all screwed up, and Reddy couldn't tell whether it was on account of the water being cold or what. Give a dog a bad name, you know.
Horse feathers, Reddy said disgustedly. Don't be a fool.
But maybe Dan was right at that. You hang a name like coward on a kid, and add something a lot of young hellions are sure to find out and jeer at, a thing the kid himself can't understand or help, but hates. And you got the makings of a first-class phobia, all right. You just imagine it yourself. Dan finished dressing and wandered outside. It was dark in the shadow of the bunkhouse, and Dan leaned back against the adobe wall, rolling a cigarette. The main house yonder was brilliant with lights, swarming with people, noisy with music and laughter, and the rhythmic shuffle of dancing feet. Pop Turner had hated the idea of turning his outfit into a dude ranch, swore he'd never give up cows to ride wet nurse on a bunch of city slickers. But June had persuaded him, and the prophets were lifting the 97 out of dangerous proximity to red ink. A girl in a short white coat and a man in black came past the corner of the main house and strolled toward the horse corral, and Dan's right hand, poised to strike the match for his smoke, halted. The girl was June Turner. He couldn't see her face against the light, but he recognized the rap, and the man was Spade Malone. There was no question. Spade's left knee was slightly stiff from a bullet wound acquired in a gambling brawl, and Dan could see that this man limped. June Turner and Spade Malone. It was generally known that the man who gave Spade his limp would have been justified if he had centered his target. Spade was that kind of gambler. And there was talk of woman trouble back of the gambling quarrel, too. Something about the loser's wife. He was the loser, too, in more ways than one. Spade was a finished gambler in a school where the 45 was better than Hoyle, and the man who nicked him was dying with Spade's slug in his chest when he drove his own bullet into Spade's knee. And June. Strange that she'd fall for such a man. Malone was handsome, but he was mean, cruel, given to sudden, insane rage. Angered, the man was dangerous as the ugly, wolfish dog he had for a pet. The couple halted at the corner of the horse corral, and Dan could hear their voices in a low, intermingling murmur. He stood in the shadow, unconscious of his eavesdropping until it was too late. The girl's white coat stood out with painful clarity against the dark, so that every move she made was clear. She leaned toward the man, lifting a face that was a ghostly blur in the moonlight. Her white sleeves raised, circling Malone, pulling him down to take her kiss. Dan turned, tiptoeing silently toward the barn. It was an hour later when Dan Coward joined the crowd in the main house, and he was still sick and strangely numb. He knew what he had seen and what it meant. June was not a girl who gave her favors lightly. And she had given them. She'd gone into Spade's arms willingly. More than willingly. Pop Turner spoke to him as he entered the house, and Dan nodded without actually hearing Turner's words. He said, "I'm leaving, Pop. Feel sort of whipped. Riding this afternoon and all. Tell June..." "Why don't you speak for yourself, John Alden?" Dan turned slowly, unwillingly, to meet June Turner's level eyes. There was laughter there and open friendliness. But Dan said woodenly, "I gotta go. Sorry." "But Dan, you haven't danced with me. You can't go without dancing with your hostess." She stopped, looking beyond him at the crowd. Dan was suddenly aware of silence. He was turning even as Malone spoke to him. Malone stood facing him, his hands hidden behind him, grinning. Back of Malone, the crowd stood motionless, all eyes upon the group there in the doorway. "I got a little present for you, coward," Malone said softly. "I've been telling the folks about your nickname,
the one we called you back in school, Kitty Coward. They wondered why we called you that. I'm going to show 'em." His hands came forward suddenly, swinging a cat. He tossed it straight at Coward's face. Dan heard a voice, his own, jagged and horrible. The cat brushed past his face and dropped to his shoulder, its claws digging. He struck at it, flung it aside. It fell hissing, back arched, its hair on end. He kicked at it. A wave of laughter hit him like an icy wave. He turned blindly, head bowed, and lurched outside. Behind him, he heard Malone's voice lifting above the crowd's laughter. "Kitty Coward! You see, folks? It fits! Kitty Coward!" In the shadow beside the bunkhouse wall, Dan found a bench and sank down on it, shivering with a reaction that was like a chill. He knew, tonight, what hell was like. Seeing June Turner in Spade Malone's arms, and now this. Before them all. Before June and June's friends, and his friends too, his neighbors. They'd laugh at him, despise him. They couldn't understand a thing like this. They couldn't know the awfulness of a sick, mad fear you couldn't fight and you couldn't control. It wasn't as if he hadn't tried to control it, to reason against it. Time and again, he thought he'd licked it. He didn't hear June until she spoke to him, and he turned startled. "I'm sorry, Dan. Dad tried to warn you. I didn't know. Would it help to talk about it?" She sat down close to him, and Dan saw that she was wearing that same coat. He hated it. Except for it, he might not have recognized her a while ago. Might not have known. Not that it made any difference, now. "I'm just what Spade said I was, June. A coward. Talking won't cure it." "But Dan, it didn't hurt you, really. It couldn't have. It was only a kitten." "Sure, only a kitten. Harmless as a kitten. That's funny. All I know is, once when I was little, I picked up a cat and I must have hurt it some way, because it struck at me, ripped my face wide open. Mother went crazy for a minute, thought I was blinded. Maybe it was her fear that did it? I don't know. Only ever since then, I've been afraid of cats. Deadly afraid. The kids at school found out. It made life hell for me. I'd fight 'em, and then somebody'd toss a cat at me, and I'd run. I've never been in a fight since, a real one, that I haven't been licked because I was expecting somebody to throw a cat in my face. I'm yellow."
"Don't be silly, Dan. Yellow? You?
Look, Dan, I saw you ride the Mad Hatter right after he'd killed Eddie Marlowe. Nobody can tell me you're yellow. You've got a complex. A phobia. Whatever you call it, it's hell."
"I know, but if you'd force yourself to fight it, make yourself fight it."
He stood up suddenly. "Sure, all it needs is guts. Guts enough to make myself beat it. Sure, that's right. Only I haven't got 'em. I've tried. And tonight, when that cat came at me, I went crazy."
"You can't fight a thing when you're crazy with fear, June, when you can't control yourself."
He wheeled, striding away from her. Later, she heard the hammer of his horse's hoofs. There was little talk among the men who gathered for breakfast at Coward's Circle 6 table next morning. Those who had been to the dance kept silent because they felt the grouch of a sleepless night, but that was only part of the reason. Talk must inevitably swing to the subject of what had happened last night, and they liked Dan. His shame was theirs. Even Dan's foreman, hard-bitten veteran, was willing to overlook a fault in a man he liked. Coming home from the dance, he'd said, "There's a streak in every man. I reckon you take the trouble to find it. I'm scared to death of frogs. Some people eat 'em, but they give me the shivers." Dan had spent a sleepless night in spite of his early departure from the dance, and he had reached a conclusion. It was not an easy one to reach, nor a happy one, but it was made. He'd sell his spread, clear out, start fresh somewhere else. The Circle 6 had been worth a nice sum when he bought it, and was worth more now, enough to set him up in the cattle business elsewhere.
It'd be easier to live where he'd not be seeing June Turner. Easier to live where men he'd meet wouldn't be hiding, or not hiding, their sneering laughter. Tecumseh, 20 miles west of the Circle Six, sweltered under the white heat of the early summer afternoon when Dan rode in. The gray dust of the street spurted up like smoke about his horse's hoofs. A buckboard stood in front of the hotel, and a collie dog under it was panting even in the shade. In the shaded sanctuary of the hotel porch, men sat, tilted far back in easy chairs, torpid with heat. One figure caught Coward's eye, and he reined his buckskin to the hitching rail and dismounted. Pop Turner spoke as Dan came up the steps.
"Hi, Dan. Hot, huh? June dragged me into town, Turner. Sit down, Dan. Take a load off your feet."
Dan nodded. Storm brewing, Pop. I want to sell the Circle Six. I rode in, figuring to list it with Parsons, but I saw you and thought you might be interested. I'll make you a price if you want it." Pop Turner removed his boots from the porch rail and let his chair down carefully. Beyond that rail, swift shadows fell across the dusty street, and a sudden rumble of thunder sent a faint tremor through the buildings.
"Look," Pop Turner said, "don't be a fool. This thing that's troubling you, it ain't as bad as you're imagining it. You're joking, Dan, ain't you?"
"I'm serious, Pop." A second peal of thunder rolled toward them swiftly and burst just overhead. Dan glanced up at the seething, churning, jet-black clouds. Rain spattered blackly on the dusty walk, and a horse snorted loudly as the cold drops stung him. Dan said, "My mind's made up. You want the spread?" Pop shrugged.
"Well, no. Of course I want it. But Lord, I have to think it over some."
Southward along the street, a screen door slammed, and a girl in a pongee skirt and tan whipcord riding breeches came briskly past the corner of a store, her high-heeled boots making a quick rhythm on the plank walk. It was June. Pop Turner saw her pass and felt a thrill of pride in her. Dan had not turned.
"Of course, if you're selling, the logical thing for me to do is buy. I see that. Wouldn't want just any Tom, Dick, or Harry bordering my range. But hell!"
June's footsteps, nearer, filled the pause. Turner's face froze.
"Good God Almighty, Dan! Looky there!"
Dan wheeled. June, turning toward the hotel steps, smiled at him. And back of her, a great black dog came loping straight across the dusty street, head swinging low, jaws slavering. The collie dozing under the buckboard stood up to make a friendly overture, and the black one slashed at him viciously, without a sound. The collie's yelp had the ring of deadly terror in it. His hackles rose. He turned and ran.
"Mad dog!"
Dan had never seen a dog gone mad before, but this one was it. Spade Malone's dog, big, surly devil, mad. He'd heard somewhere that mad dogs fear water. Perhaps it was true. Perhaps the dog was running from the rain. June reached the steps, and Turner yelled at her. But it was Dan who leaped and caught her arms and flung her into Turner's hands. And as he leaped, he swept his Stetson off his head, making a glove of it. The hat, with Dan's left fist behind it, drove out straight into foam-flecked jaws. The dog had leaped without a pause, growling. The slaver from his jaws stained June's short skirt. Dan's blow went to the throat, hurling the beast aside. As he fell, the dog snapped sideways like a wolf, his poison teeth ripping the felt of Coward's hat. A gun barked heavily, and Turner wondered how Dan had managed to draw so swiftly. One shot, the red flame licking down into a tawny chest, and that was all. Dan turned slowly, wiping the slaver from his hand. Turner saw that the hand was clean, unmarked. The dog had missed. Pop gulped, seeking for words. Dan sheathed his gun. The hotel door burst outward suddenly under the impact of a hard-driven shoulder, and Dan's eyes lifted instantly, traveling past Turner. Pop saw Dan's lips draw thin and tight.
Malone stood just outside that door, crouched low, his elbows bent. He wasn't handsome now. His face was flushed and oddly twisted. His eyes were red, like the dog's eyes had been when he leaped.
"You killed him." Malone's voice was low, rasping, choking him. "Killed him to get even with me for last night. Afraid to tackle me. You killed my dog."
It wasn't that. The dog was mad.
"You lie."
It was insane, of course, yet it was real. Malone's right hand struck down, jerking his gun. Dan saw the deadly purpose in Malone's red eyes. Pop Turner yelled. Dan lunged straight out, shooting his fist to Spade's jaw. His left shot home. The quick spat-spat of his fists on flesh was sharp and clear. Malone went back a pace, head rolling under jolting blows. He fell, and Dan stood over him. Pop Turner knelt and snatched Spade's gun. It struck Dan that he was not afraid. Waiting for Spade to rise, he knew a hunger for more battle. He hoped desperately that Spade would rise. All fear was lost in the wild, savage thrill of fighting, of solid blows well targeted. He thought, "Maybe I've never been this mad before," and he was amused. Malone stayed where he fell. He'd had enough. Boots thudded heavily along the walk, and Dan turned to face a growing crowd. A dozen men had materialized out of nowhere and stood staring, their voices making a little curious din. They were wet, most of them. The rain was falling now in a steady downpour. The voices were still all of a sudden, and Dan faced Spade Malone. He was on his feet, weaving, his thick lips smashed into a bloody smear.
"You just postponed it, Dan." "Turner, give me my gun."
Pop shook his head.
"Not now. I'll leave it at the hotel desk. You can get it when I'm gone."
A muscle alongside Spade's mouth twitched nervously. He scowled and nodded. He said softly,
"When I get my gun, I'm coming after you. If you're a man, you'll wait for me."
He glanced down at the body of his dog lying there in the eavesdrop. There was silence around him as he turned and walked down the steps and away down the street. There was silence afterward while two men lifted the dog, carried it to the end of the porch, and dropped it over the rail, out of sight. The crowd was waiting, watching Dan. Dan saw, instead, bright moonlight on a girl's white coat, two figures, man and girl, standing beside a horse corral. The girl's arms lifted hungrily. She raised her lips. She loved the man. There was no doubt of that. No earthly doubt of it. In a little while, that man would come hunting for Dan. He could meet him, talk to him in Gunsmoke, or leave the country. He wasn't afraid to meet Malone. He'd met him once today and beaten him. He could again. He knew that, and the thought of doing it brought no fear with it. And yet, he could not, either. Not when it meant what it would mean to June. No, he would leave. That's what the town expected him to do. It wouldn't surprise anyone. Yet, it was harder somehow to pretend a fear than it had been to mask it. If he faced Malone today, there would be no fear in him again, ever. He knew that, without knowing how he knew it. But if he ran... Pop Turner said,
"Thank you, son. That was a nervy thing. I'm thanking you. He would have had June, sure."
Dan shrugged. "It was safe enough," he said slowly. "I covered my hand with my hat."
"Yeah, his teeth tore through that hat like it was paper. If he'd gone an eighth inch deeper..."
Dan grinned. "Maybe if I'd thought of that, I wouldn't have done it."
"Maybe you wouldn't,"
Pop said softly, but there was no conviction in his tone.
"Anyway, I'm a-thanking you, boy. And it ain't over, Dan. Malone meant what he said. You ain't forgetting that, are you?"
Dan said, "I'm not forgetting it. I'm leaving town." One of the men on the porch laughed oddly and turned. One by one, the others followed him, filing in through the hotel lobby to the bar. Someone said harshly,
See? What'd I tell you? A flash in the pan. Acted without thinking. Now that he's had time to think.
The roar of rain on the tin roof and the hard crash of the thunder shut off those sounds when June said, "Dan?" Dan turned. She stood between him and the steps.
"You've whipped your fear. That's true, isn't it?"
He shrugged.
"It doesn't look that way, does it? You heard what I said."
"But you weren't afraid a while ago, not of the dog, nor a balloon. I watched you, Dan. I saw your eyes. I know."
"Why don't you meet him, Dan?"
Dan stared at her.
"You mean, you want me to?"
"I'd kill him, June. I'm faster with a gun than Spade."
"I know."
"But June, I thought you loved him. I saw you in his arms last night." Her head jerked up.
"Last night? You're crazy, Dan. What did you see?"
He told her, spilling words in one swift rush that faltered, oddly, as he saw the sudden gleam of laughter in her eyes.
"But Dan, that wasn't me. Silly, you should have known."
"Not you? But June, the coat.
I loaned the coat to Betty Duane, one of my dudes. The little fool. I didn't know she'd set her cap for Spade. I'll have to talk to her."
A sheet of flame broke blindingly around them then, and the crash of thunder was like an explosion. June screamed and came straight into Dan's encircling arms. She was laughing, but there was a trace of hysteria in her laughter. Dan held her, his big hands soothing her. She said,
"You see, I'm scared of something, too. I've got a phobia. I'm terrified when lightning bangs like that. I've always been."
Dan's laughter rolled in time with hers, deep in his throat. "We'll make a pair, then, won't we? You scared of thunder? Me of cats." Something brushed lightly past Dan's leg. He felt it dimly through his riding boot. It came again. June stirred and looked down suddenly. Dan bent his head to brush her hair. She pulled away from him.
"Look, Dan,"
and waited, watching him. He looked, following her pointing finger. A great black cat, back arched, leaned on his boot and purred, rubbing herself full length. He stood watching her. She turned, winding herself between his feet. He raised his eyes. They met June's questioning gaze steadily. There was no panic in him, no fear. He said,
"I'm not afraid of it. See, June, I'm not afraid of it."
She nodded happily.
"I see. It's over, Dan. You won't even have to fight Malone to beat it. You've beaten it already."
Dan's laughter had a rich, exultant ring in it.
"I'll meet him, though," he said. "I'll take that cat and stuff it down his doggone throat. I'll make him eat it, fur and all."
And that was Fighting Coward by E.B. Mann. Our second story is from a different magazine of the same period. This story is from Street and Smith's Western Story Magazine of June 3, 1939, and it's entitled Illegal Interest by Ben Jones. Jim Dobie set his placer pan on a rock and turned toward the west. His eyes squinted against the glare on the parched stretch of sand that spread out below him. Cactus sentinels wavered, swayed in the heat. Jim scanned the horizon anxiously, hoping that one of the wavering objects might materialize into a figure on horseback, for Hank Long was long past due. Calvajo was only 2 hours' ride from the Bola mine, and Hank had been gone 12 hours. Jim Dobie's young face was taut with anxiety. The tension in his face eased a little, and his blue eyes brightened as he dipped for a pan of gravel and water. It was fun to watch the sun glitter on the particles of gold in the bottom of the pan as he tilted it from side to side. There wasn't a richer strike in the Sierras than this claim he and Hank were working. Unconsciously, Jim's left hand went to the breast pocket of his plaid shirt, felt the crinkle of paper there. That crisp paper was a letter from the Northwestern Mining Company testifying to the richness of the Bola mine.
it announced that when Jim Dobie and Hank Long appeared at the Northwestern Mining Company's office in Tucson, the company was ready to pay them a small fortune for their claim. Jim turned back to scan the shimmering desert below. It was just one catch. In 12 more hours, the Bola mine would not be theirs to sell unless Hank turned up with the money needed to take up their option on the property. One of the swaying shadows in the glare took definite shape, became a man on horseback. When Jim Dobie saw the hunched rider astride a loping horse, he headed for the foot of the rise at a run. The rider was Hank Long, and something was wrong. Hank loved that piebald horse too much to run her in this kind of heat. At the foot of the rise, Hank pulled up, struggling to sit erect in his saddle. When Jim Dobie reached his partner's side, the old man was cursing between panting gasps for breath.
"Help me up the hill," he choked. "This blankety-blank shoulder is giving me merry hell."
The right side of Hank's dusty plaid shirt was dyed deep brown with dried blood. His wizened, leathery face was twisted into a maze of painful wrinkles. His straggly walrus mustache looked even more droopy than usual, but there was a vibrant, angry glow in his faded eyes. While Jim bathed and dressed the gun wound in his skinny shoulder, Hank Long talked. Occasionally, he took time out to curse, and Jim's young face settled into tight, grim lines as he listened.
"Lem Craig turned us down cold on the loan," Hank declared. "Said the bank ain't in a position to lend money now. I know he's a liar. Argued for 2 hours yesterday. He kept a stallin'. Come back this morning. When he stalled me again, I demanded a showdown."
"Does he know when our option on the mine is up?" Jim asked. Hank nodded.
"Sure he does. Ain't he working for Simon Luke? And don't Luke own the Bola? Or will if we don't pick up that option tomorrow? Anyway, this morning I accused Lim of refusing us the loan because he'd been ordered to do just that by his boss, Simon Luke. He blustered, but I could tell he was lying. I got sore and, well, maybe I looked a little like I was going for my gun, but..."
"I ain't betting maybe on that, you old pepper pot," Jim put in dryly. "That temper and fool daring of yours is going to get you killed yet."
"Well, I ain't taking a deal like that without putting up a fight, but that buzzard Craig beat me to the draw."
Hank's voice was heavy with tragic mournfulness.
"Jim, I must be getting old. I'm getting soft when a parlor dandy like Lem Craig can outdraw me. He shot him in the shoulder before I could get my gun out."
Hank began to curse again. Jim Dobie tied a knot in the bandana he'd put on Hank's shoulder and stood up. "You can't handle Craig like that, Hank," he said. "He's a banker, not an outlaw. And this ain't the Old West. There's law and order out here now."
"Then Craig ain't got no right acting like an outlaw," Hank protested. "And he's using that law and order stuff to hold us up. We're law-abiding citizens. We got collateral, ironclad security, to put up for that loan. Bankers is supposed to help citizens."
"I think we can get the loan from Craig if he's approached right," Jim told him. "Maybe he was telling the truth. Maybe he didn't have the cash on hand. But if he'll give us a certified check..."
"It's Tuesday," Hank said shortly. "That means the stage is due today with the bank's weekly supply of cash from Tucson. Everybody knows that."
Jim Dobie turned, picked up his saddle. "I'm going to see Craig myself. We've got to get that option money to Simon Luke before noon tomorrow." Hank's spindly, bowed legs trembled as he stood up. He walked over to where Jim was saddling his horse.
"Look, son," he said quietly, "I'm a short-tempered old fool, I know. But I didn't pull a gun on Craig till I'd tried everything else. Craig takes his orders from Simon Luke, and he ain't going to give us that loan. Now that we've found gold on his claim, Luke wants it back. And he can get it back if we don't show up at his place with $3,000 before noon tomorrow."
Jim looked grim and determined. "It's the only chance we've got, Hank. I'm going to see Craig." There was a strained look in Hank's faded eyes as he watched his young partner mount his horse.
"Craig and Luke use the law to hide behind while they rob and steal. They've skinned many a prospector out of rich claims around here, and they're aiming to skin us. There ain't but one way to deal with skunks like that, Jim. You gotta show...
Shooting them won't get us anywhere, Hank, Jim interrupted. You'll just swing for murder, and that ain't getting the mine for us. Things like this have to be done legal. Outlaw methods won't work. Hank shook his head mournfully.
But Craig and Luke is outlaws, Jim. Not the old-fashioned kind that robbed honest with a mask and gun, but outlaws just the same. And you gotta play the game their way or they take the pants off of you.
But Jim Doby shook his head stubbornly. You take it easy with that shoulder. If I get the money, I'll ride on up to Simon Luke's and pick up that deed. If I fail, Jim didn't finish. He didn't have to. 6 months' hard work and all the money he and Hank had saved for years was sunk in the bola. If they lost now, they'd not only lose a fortune, but every last cent they had. There would be nothing left for them but become roving cowpunchers again, and Hank wasn't as spry as he used to be. Old Hank watched his young partner become a part of the wavering mirage that floated across the trail to Cavajo. His eyes looked after him, but their faraway expression showed that he had forgotten his partner already. There was a glitter in the faded eyes, something in the old man's bearing that was alien to the despair that filled his partner. The piebald horse picked up his ears and stared at Hank as the miner spoke aloud.
If Craig won't do business like an honest man, then there ain't nothing left to do but business his way. Jim's a good kid, but he just don't understand human nature.
Hank chuckled as he turned and picked up the saddle Jim had taken from the piebald horse. There was new life in his step as he turned toward the corral where their one extra horse stood.
Jim just don't know nothing about psychology, he murmured.
Jim Doby faced Lem Craig across the banker's roll-top desk. Craig's bland smile was cautiously bland. I'm sorry, Jim, he said regretfully, but I can't make the loan. Actually, the mine ain't yours and Hank's to put up for collateral. Legally, it's ours for another 12 hours, Jim Doby pointed out. I've shown you this letter from the Northwestern people. By tomorrow night, we can repay the loan with interest. With double interest, if you want it that way. Craig shook his head. There was a sly, uneasy look in his little eyes. His fat face showed the nervousness as he turned toward the grim-faced young miner.
I can't do it, Doby, he insisted, and I wish you'd stop.
Craig broke off as the sound that had been gathering outside in the street rose to a roar and almost drowned him out. He and Jim Doby turned and faced the door as the thud of many boot heels and the excited clamor of voices grew louder outside the door. The banker moved to the door, threw it open. Past Craig's shoulder, Jim Doby saw the crowd that filled the bank. A glimpse through the wide-open front doors showed him the stagecoach pulled up in front of the bank. An excited cashier headed the crowd that moved toward the door of Craig's office. Beside the cashier was a white-faced stage driver, carrying a satchel which he thrust out toward Craig as he reached the door. The banker motioned the cashier and the driver into the room and closed the door. Then he took the satchel. As he faced the nervous driver, he seemed to have forgotten Jim Doby's presence.
"What happened?" he demanded.
"Was there a holdup?" The driver nodded.
"Yep, at Panther Pass. A lone masked agent. Didn't take nothing but the bank's money. And he writ something on a piece of paper and put it in the bag. Said it's for you."
Jim Doby was standing at Craig's shoulder as he opened the satchel. It was empty except for the slip of paper. Jim recognized the scrawled writing before he read the signature at the end. The message read, "I owe the Calvajo Bank $20,000. Signed, Hank Long." Craig stared at the note, his eyes bulging angrily. The cashier and the white-faced driver cringed perceptibly beneath his glare. Jim Doby took a step toward the door. Craig whirled.
"You, Jim Doby," he rasped. "You're a party to this. I'm going to have you arrested as Hank Long's accomplice."
Jim opened the door and glanced out. The crowd had drifted away. He could see some of them standing around the coach outside, talking about the holdup. Reaching for his gun,
Jim turned to face Craig again. The banker's voice broke off at the sight of the boar aimed at his heart. The color left his fat cheeks.
"Hank was right about you, Craig," Dobie said coldly. "If you weren't a greedy, grasping skinflint, Hank wouldn't have done this. You can't arrest me for nothing, and if you do get me arrested, it's going to be for murder. Your murder."
Craig shrank back against the desk. Disgust showed in Dobie's face.
"You come out of this room afore I've forked my horse, and you're a dead man," he warned.
He left the office, closing the door behind him. As he made for the front of the bank, he knew that fear would keep the banker there for a few minutes, but greed would spur Craig to have a posse on his trail as soon as he thought it was safe. The sheriff's office was next door to the bank. As Jim Dobie forked his horse, he nodded to the officer who stood on the front porch of the jail. As Jim reached the edge of town, the sound of a gunshot crashed the silence. He spurred his horse to a run without looking around. Craig had gotten up the courage to give the alarm. The trail Jim Dobie took led to Tucson. Side roads led off along it farther up, one to the Bola Mine, another to Simon Luke's spread. As he rode, Jim Dobie weighed several things. He could head for the mine, lead the posse there deliberately. He knew Hank wouldn't go to the mine. Even the slow-thinking Craig would get around to figuring out where Hank would go. But Craig probably wouldn't figure it out until the posse had failed to find Hank at the mine. But when Craig finally thought of that place and sent his posse looking for Hank, Jim Dobie decided he had better be there too. The old fool had pulled a crazy stunt, but, after all, they were partners.
"He'll get hisself hanged yet," Dobie muttered disgustedly, "and I reckon I'll be siding him when he swings."
Undoubtedly, Hank meant to pay Luke for the bola, then sell it to the Midwestern people. But how he expected to gain anything by holding up a bank's messenger to get the money to put the deal over, Jim Dobie just couldn't see.
"Makes just about as much sense as pulling a gun on Lem Craig when he wouldn't give him that loan. What good will owning the mine do if we both go to jail?"
Jim Dobie glanced back and urged the little mare faster along the trail as the drum of many hoofbeats grew louder. Wasn't nothing he could do right now but get to Hank.
"Might as well leave this country fast as we can ride. Reckon there's as much work for a couple of cowhands down in Texas as here in Arizona, if we can outride the sheriff."
But before he'd reached the trail that turned off to the Bola Mine, he knew there'd be no outriding the posse. His horse was too tired, and theirs were fresh.
"Just one thing to do," he muttered as he jerked the horse off the trail, headed her up the side path that led to the Bola. "Reckon I'll try an old trick and hope for the best."
He set his horse, waiting, a little way off the main trail. As the first of the sheriff's posse came in sight, Jim Dobie spurred his horse toward the mine. At the same time, he turned in his saddle, aimed and recklessly fired 5 shots back toward the main trail.
"They'll reckon I must be scared out of my wits to do such a fool thing," he muttered.
The ruse worked. The posse left the main road, headed up the trail after Dobie. The sun was setting and the long shadows grew blacker. Dobie went around a curve in the trail. He jerked the mare abruptly to the left, slipped out of the saddle, and pulled the horse behind a thick clump of brush. He just had time to shove his Stetson over the mare's face when the posse rounded the curve. Jim Dobie held his breath, crouched low, until the last of the sheriff's outfit passed on up the trail. They were going at a lope. The sheriff knew the trail led to the mine. He'd figured Jim Dobie meant to barricade himself there and to fight it out. Soon as they were out of sight, Jim turned and galloped back to the main road. Before the sheriff discovered the ruse, Jim would have a head start for Tucson, and the law officer would probably go back to town for further orders from Craig before he followed. It wouldn't be any use trying to catch Hank at Simon Luke's. With the start Hank had, he would be on his way to Tucson by now. A smile came to light Jim Dobie's face suddenly. If Craig was smarter, Hank wouldn't have got any further than Luke's. But I reckon Hank was gambling on Craig's dumbness a little. Dawn was hitting the western sky when Jim Dobie rode into Tucson.
It was a draw as to who was the wearier, he or the wiry little mare. As he headed up the deserted main street, Jim patted the tired horse gently on the dusty neck. "You'll get a week's rest up for this, little horse," he said. The mare pricked up her ears at the sound of his voice and struggled to break into a trot. Jim Doby didn't expect to find the Midwestern Mining Company's office open at this hour, though he thought he might find Hank there waiting. So when he rode up and saw a light in the window of the mining company's office, Jim's eyes opened in surprise. "Reckon it's like Hank, at that, to pull that Midwestern outfit out of bed to close the deal." The official to whom Jim Doby had given samples of Bola ore 3 weeks before opened the door to his knock. Hank was at the man's shoulder.
"Come on in, Jim," Hank drawled. "I told Mr. Sweeney here you'd likely show up in time to sign these papers with me."
Mr. Sweeney didn't seem surprised at the lateness of the hour they had picked to do business. Prospectors, he explained, as he fussily arranged papers, came in at all hours. They had to do business and get back to their mines. He understood. He slept in the rear of the building for just such emergencies. The sun was showing above the horizon when they came out of the office. Hank waved the Midwestern check to dry the ink as they walked across the porch.
"You take that mare of yours over to the livery stable, rent yourself a fresh horse, son," Hank said. "We gotta get going."
Jim Doby frowned. "And fast," he said. "That note you left in the bank satchel was the craziest trick. If you had to hold up that messenger, Hank, why in the name of sin did you write out a confession?" Hank's grin stopped him.
"Look, son, you get that horse and we'll head for Calvajo. We got no time to hold postmortems now. Besides, I can't wait to see Lem Craig's face when..."
Jim Doby's jaw dropped. Now it clicked into place with a snap. "Calvajo? Hank, have you gone plumb loco? We got a ride all right, but we're riding as fast as we can out of this neck of the woods. There's a posse on the way to Tucson now, and it's gunning for..."
"You get that fresh horse," Hank said mildly. "We're heading for Calvajo. Reckon you can't get in much more trouble, so might as well let me finish this here deal. And you'll have to take my word for it, son. I ain't a-just shooting wild. I got my reasons."
Half an hour later, Jim Doby rode down the street astride a fresh horse. The town was awake now, and the main street was milling with horses and wagons and people. Jim searched the crowd for Hank. He saw Hank step out of the Tucson bank. He was waving something white to and fro. When Jim reached the bank, Hank was mounted on his own horse. His hat was in his hand, and he was fitting the white slip of paper he'd brought out of the bank inside the inner band of his dusty old Stetson.
"Let's ride, son," he said before Jim could ask any questions. "I'll put our money in the bank. When we've settled with Lem Craig, we'll come back and..."
"Can't see that that money is going to do us much good anyway if we go back to Calvajo," Jim put it impatiently. "Even if we get there, there's a posse on the trail that we're sure to run into." Hank chuckled.
"Sure, I figured that, son. We ain't going to run into that air posse."
Hank had prospected this part of the country all his life. He knew every burro trail as far as the Sierras. He told his partner of a side trail they could take.
"It's rougher and a little longer, but we won't run into that there posse."
They rode hard and fast, and there wasn't time for talk. All the way, Jim Doby thought. He was a fool to let Hank lead him into a corner like this. But for the life of him, he couldn't see any way out. Well, he might as well go the whole hog. He'd followed Hank this far. As they rode into Calvajo, people on the boardwalk that ran down either side of the main street turned to stare after them. By the time they dismounted in front of the bank, quite a crowd had collected. It was a silent, curious crowd. Everyone knew there was a posse out for the two partners, but it was Lem Craig's business. They were willing to let the banker fight his own battles. Lem Craig's reaction to the two prospectors wasn't reassuring. Jim Doby noted the triumph in the fat face, the glitter in the piggy eyes that brightened at the sight of them. The banker had a gun on them when he rose from the chair behind the roll-top desk.
You're under arrest, Hank Long, he snarled.
Put up that shooting iron, Lamb, Hank said mildly. You can't arrest nobody. Anyway, we're here in business. Legitimate business. He chuckled. We're going to do this legal-like, Lem, just like you.
You're under arrest, Craig repeated doggedly. You robbed this bank of $20,000, and you're going to jail for it.
Hank looked surprised, but patient.
You got things a little mixed up, Lem. I borrowed $20,000 from your bank. There's a heap of difference in borrowing and stealing. And I'm here to pay you back the loan, the proper interest added.
Triumph leaped into Craig's small, pig-like eyes. He glanced at the cashier who stood in the doorway.
Get a deputy. I want a lawman to witness when I search them to testify that we found the bank's stolen money on these outlaws.
Hank's chuckle didn't warn Craig. But Jim Dobie relaxed a little. He didn't see how in tarnation Hank was going to get out of that hold-up confession, but he knew the signs. Hank held a trump card of some sort. A young deputy came on the run. He looked eager but bewildered as he turned to Craig for orders.
Hank Long just confessed he's carrying the money he stole from the bank, Craig told the lawman. I want you to be witness to its removal.
But a thorough search of Hank and Jim Dobie's persons failed to reveal any money. A search of their saddlebags also was fruitless. Lem Craig's face began to drop.
That note you left in the satchel is a confession, Hank Long, he snarled. You got the bank's money. It'll go hard with you if you don't give it back.
Hank's voice was soft and calm. There was, now that the young deputy sheriff had appeared, a fine show of injured innocence in his manner. Jim Dobie watched his partner with reluctant admiration.
I'm to pay back the money I borrowed, Lem, Hank said patiently. You got my signed note, legal above board for the loan. If you'll get the note now. Where's the money? Rasped Lem Craig. Where's my money? If you withdrew that highway robbery charge against me, Lem, I'll pay off that note with interest.
Calmly, Hank shifted his tobacco.
But you don't get 1 cent of that $20,000 back that I borrowed from your bank, Lem, if you send me to jail.
The banker's eyes were bulging, his fat jowls shaking with anger.
$20,000 is a big price to pay for the satisfaction of seeing me behind bars, Lem, Hank went on. Simon Luke ain't going to want to see his bank lose that much money, neither.
Deliberately, Hank sent a stream of tobacco juice across 6 feet of space, nearly hitting the center of the spittoon at Craig's feet.
Especially now that nothing Simon can do getting back the bowl of mine.
A look of surprise and uncertainty showed in Craig's face.
The bola is legally the property of the Midwestern Mining Company, Hank went on. Sold to them this morning, and Simon Luke's got his $3,000 for the claim. I got his receipt to prove it, locked safely in the Bank of Tucson, Lem, and I'm ready to pay you back that loan the minute you produce the note I signed.
Craig tried one more bluff.
Where's the money? He sneered. You ain't got it on you. Where'd you hide it? Get the note, Hank said quietly, and I'll give you legal tender for it, interest and all.
Craig turned to the cashier and nodded. There was silence until the man returned with the note Hank had left in the bank satchel. Hank reached for it, but Craig drew back suspiciously.
All right, said Hank. Let the deputy here hold the note till you get your pay.
As he handed the note to the young deputy, Craig snarled.
Keep your eyes on these outlaws. They're up to pulling something crooked.
Hank chuckled.
I ain't never seen a man fight so hard against earning a little interest as you, Lem.
He reached for the battered hat he had flung to Craig's desk as the deputy searched him. Craig watched with the suspicious alertness of a ferret as Hank pulled back the sweat-stained band inside the hat and took out a narrow slip of paper which he handed to the banker.
That there's a certified check on the Tucson Bank, Lem, he said, for the $20,000, plus interest.
He chuckled.
That there interest might be a mite illegal, but I reckon it ain't the first time you took a bit of illegal interest for yourself, Lem, huh?
Craig was staring at the check.
Hank stuck a stogie into his withered mouth. He reached for a match, struck it on his thigh. As the flame flared up, he leaned over swiftly and touched the flame to the note the young deputy held. As the paper flared, the startled lawman dropped it on the floor. Hank stopped Craig's leap for it.
"That's legal too, Lamb," he said firmly. "You got your money. That there note's mine now. Let it burn to a crisp, Jim. I don't trust the law-abiding business methods of our town banker."
As the two partners forked their horses and headed for home, Hank was still chuckling.
"I knew Lem Craig wouldn't take a chance on losing $20,000. His greedy soul wouldn't enjoy revenge if he had to pay that much for it."
Jim Dobie tried not to show too much approval. "I still say them crazy stunts of yours is going to get you in trouble yet," he said gruffly. "Your luck won't hold forever, Hank."
"Son?"
Hank's voice was gentle, patient.
"How many times have I got to tell you? It ain't luck. It's psychology. Plain psychology."
And that was Illegal Interest by Ben Jones. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.